Next session number 12882, Mr. and Mrs. Howe, Reel 2.
Cowlings, the special cowlings for the, I think it was TriStar, I think that was called. But it was actually, it was for Rolls Royce. The bits were made for Rolls Royce, for the road body of RB211.
Mm. The main parts were for the Concorde. And, yeah, it was sort of lovely to sort of see, you know, see the bits going on and that. But I was saying that was...
So that was only sections, it was assembled at Filton, wasn't it? We made the forward.
Their
runway wasn't long enough
and that. Forward fuselage and one or two other sub-assemblies.
I watched the last VC-10 go off air runway because that was the only thing I could do. That was a real thrill and that, because we used to watch them go off as they did. And they got off, that was the last...
So that was, is the plane that's still flying? Because the VC-10s virtually finished. I mean,
some of the VC-10s still are, yeah. Oh,
they're making them to tankers, aren't they? Yeah. But not as airliners anymore.
But when we finished at 46, when we finished up, of course, we weren't building Wellingtons at the end of the war. We were building a machine slightly bigger called the Warwick. And lots of those were made for the air sea rescue job. And the air sea rescue boat, actually, the actual boat part,
Well, that they drop.
Yes, was designed by Arthur Fox from Cowes. I don't know, you know anything about Arthur Fox, do you? He's the old boat.
I've sailed his Flying 15.
You did? Well,
not his personal one, but I mean, he designed the Flying 15.
Yeah, well, he used to come. That hangar, where they've got now, where they have got those machines in the
Wellington
bit and the what's the other thing they've got in there?
Well, they've got the Harrier, haven't they?
That's right. Yeah. Well, that hangar, Arthur Fox used to come there into that hangar, and we had that hangar there, but I worked with other people, of course, on it. And we used to do the different attachments for the parachutes on there, and we had Hanley Page hand winches, first of all, after that. And
when I was only 8 months old, of course, my father was on the works manager of the Tabor, the Tarrant triplane.
Oh, yes.
And so that was, you know, where we started on that.
Do you remember much about your father and the work he did? Did you actually see the table as a child or anything?
No, little bits of it out in the there, because it crashed on the sort of on the maiden flight, and I saw bits of it because the factory, the one that was only wooden sheds and that, was sort of right next to our garden, because the houses, I was 8 months old and my father was called down to sort of do it. And where did he come from? Dad, where did he come from? Oh, we lived in Dollis Hill, actually. And
well, he was actually working at Hendon.
Hendon, that's right. And he came down to be the works manager of WD Tarrant for the Tarrant triplane, or they call it the Tabor. And it was built just out in the yard, just alongside our garden and that. And
but you were 8 months then, so you don't remember much of
that. I don't remember on that, and, but I do know he sort of told us since, and we've had sort of, well, we've given pictures to the museum and that, and apparently it went on its maiden flight, and my father, well, he's a bit of a coward, and he said he'd sort of sprained his ankle a bit, so he didn't go, because he was a bit dubious about it, because it went on, and they'd all been drinking prior to that. And they went on there, of course it crashed, unfortunately, and that was the end of that. And of course the end of the war, so they didn't have it, you know, that was the end of it.
And they were all killed, were they, on board?
All killed, yes. And so that was the end of the Tabor. And then, of course, he went then on to work at Claridge's Hotel. He was the clerk of the works there. And he worked there for until the war started.
Where was that? Where was the hotel? Claridge's Hotel?
Claridge's Hotel.
Claridge's Hotel.
Mm. And he worked there until the war started in 1939. And then he stayed about another year or more, and then he found the journey was bad and that, so he came down then and came to work at Vickers with Mr. Chidsey on the rate fixing and that, and so that was he did his sort of bit in there, you know, during the war. And then when the war finished, he went back to Claridge's Hotel. And
you worked there for a bit, didn't you?
That was where I worked. He just from school. I left school and that, and he said, "I've got a job for you." I said, "Thank you very much." So that was where it was, in Claridge's Hotel and that. So I stayed, I worked there until I was married and that. Which
Do you remember any of the guests who were there, the well-known ones?
Yes, yeah. Lord Reeve-Smith and the Prince of Wales that was then, and Mrs.
Simpson.
She used to have our suite there, 401, 2 and 3, and he used to come up in the luggage lift to come and see her. And Mr. Simpson was in the Girls Club right next door at the same time, because he wasn't there, but she was there. And the Queen of Norway used to sort of come there regularly. She used to have to come over about the 3 months or something to sort of get her money from this country, because she was married to the King of Norway, and that she used to still come back for her money. Queen Ina of Norway, she used to have the 312, 13 and 14, the corner suite, because all the royal suites were on the corner. And so she used to come over a third time. And then I saw many of the film stars, and I say it was quite interesting in that respect.
What was your job there?
I was a sort of like receptionist and that, plus I was in the fact I was on the to do with the upholstery and that, you know, sort of allocating the curtains, sorting the curtains out, and the, all the things in the room, together with the upholsterers and a few of the you know, staff and that. And because my father's job was, he was in charge of all the painters, the decorators, the whole lot of them. They had, you know, they sort of the rooms and that. And he was Mr. Doyley Cart was his upper boss as regards that, and that he was always there, Doyley Cart.
Gilbert Sullivan man.
Yeah, the Gilbert Sullivan man. Mm. And I've even got his signatures on some of the father's past, on some of his, went on strike, that didn't go on strike, so they gave them shares in Claridge's Hotel. Of course, they've been he redeemed those some time ago. Mm. And then when he died, his daughter took over, and she used to sort of go around and help with my father, sort of choosing all the different colours. Bridget, that's what Bridget does.
I thought they were connected with the Savoy. I didn't know they were connected with Claridge's.
Well, Savoy, Barclay and Claridge's were all together.
Oh, were they?
But Claridge's was the one more or less where they had the more the royalty and more the other. Oh, yes, Savoy, Barclay and Claridge's all kind of, they sort of split now. Yes, Claridge's.
Who were the film stars you remember who started there?
Miriam Hopkins, Joan Bennett, David Niven, the Fairbanks, you know, used to see them. I used to look at Rex sometimes in the morning and that, but and oh, quite a lot of them. And then, of course, they used to have these big mannequin parades and that. And Mrs. Charles Sweeney, she used to sort of come there to them, you know, when she was married to Charles Sweeney, because she was who was she before? Duchess of Argyll, wasn't she? Afterwards and that, and we used to get, peep in and see those, stay behind and see all these. It was really very interesting and that. I mean, I didn't get much money, but it was never sort of less. It was sort of very interesting to see it all. And London life, I thoroughly enjoyed that. But I was, when I went to town, well, I lived at Byfleet, just near the town, and our fares were 1 and 3 return on the workman's. 7:11 in the morning.
Well, from Byfleet to Waterloo?
Byfleet to Waterloo, 1 and 3 return in the old currency, and 2 on the tube from Waterloo to Bond Street. But at night, I used to walk from Bond Street to either Charing Cross to or Piccadilly to save a halfpenny, and then sort of walked the whole time. If I had time, that said tuppence. So by the end of the week, I got sixpence. I could buy a yard of material in John Lewis's. And so it only took sort of about 3 or 4 journeys to get 3 yards, because I made all my own clothes, to get 3 yards then to make a dress. And that's in those days, because your wages were poor and that. But anyway, that was what the fair was then. And so that was how we used to be able to save our money, because, I mean, by the time we'd given Mother money out of... Oh, I earned 2 guineas a week, 2 guineas when I first went there. By the time I'd given her my fare and paid a little bit of keep, I hadn't got much left. I think I had 9 pence left for the pictures I wanted to get, which we had to walk to Walton if we wanted to, or to Woking, because we hadn't got the fare. Now, my friend and I, that was... Mm. That, so. But I say, we thoroughly enjoyed in those days. We were quite happy. We didn't sort of have any grudges or anything like that. Mm. And then...
Well, you didn't have your expectations whipped up like they have nowadays with these intensive advertising campaigns. Borrow money, buy this, buy that, buy the other.
Never. Because,
We were taught from when we were very young, never get into debt.
Yes, that was one of my father's strict sort of things. Never get into debt. When we first were engaged, there were new houses going up then in parts of Byfleet, and I think you had to put around about £5 towards them. But I mean, we couldn't. He said, "You're not going to put a millstone round your neck," and that was my father's thing. So he said, "No, you're not going."
What do these houses cost in those days?
550 to 600, and they were all round by the recreation ground in Byfleet, and along in Tewkesbury Close, and also along round the back of the church way, round towards the rectory and that. And that was all they were. One next to the recreation ground, we sort of would have loved. But that was £600. But he would not, and, you know, so he said, no, he said, it's silly. Well, perhaps we were silly. We should have sort of been a bit stronger ourselves, really, because with two of us working, well, I would have liked a family earlier, but...
Well, the thing about
nothing
it
came along.
And the mortgage rates weren't high. I mean, it was Dalton's cheap money, wasn't it? Just 2% or something.
The thing about it all is, really, of course, is the fact that when we did get married, the estate agents were shut anyway, you see. Because of the war. As soon as the war came, that was it. It was all shut down.
He's only earning about £3 a week, which wasn't much in that. And then I... Jobs to rent a house was an awful job to get one, but I eventually managed to hear that one was going with Mr. Mears, and that who we were quite friendly with, so he managed to get that. But that was £1 a week even in 1939, which was rather a lot of money, because all vicars people had their own houses, and they were only paying about 9 shillings to 11 shillings in the vicars' cottages.
Well, this was rent.
The rent, yes. Mm. So they were very lucky, really. And of course, when the war finished, they were able to buy them from 500 and 550, and people that have only just hadn't long moved in there. So, but we stayed in ours till about how many years? 60 years, weren't we there?
Eight. We left Byfleet in 81.
That's right. I mean, I was 60, wasn't I? So, I'd lived in Byfleet 60 years, that was what it was. I lived in Byfleet 60 years. And then we, from 1939 to 1981, but Mr. Mears sold the houses and that, and then we were paying higher rent, and then I think the landlord wanted to knock some other houses down, but they were lovely old houses, character and that, and of course he couldn't get away with it. So in the end, we were a liability, which I said to them, so we were able to buy it. Mother hadn't long died, and we were able to sort of buy it at a reasonable price as sitting tenants and that, so... That was how we were able to, otherwise we'd paid rent all our years, able to sort of buy a house and then to move and that. But we moved when all properties were very, very low, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Because my house, was, after 2 years, went for 100,000 more than I'd sold it for. But
tell me a bit about when the war came, and because... rationing and so on.
Rationing, yeah.
That really, I mean, that restricted you even more, didn't it?
It does, terrible, yes, terrible. I mean, sort of food, we queued for ages. I mean, and we got about half an ounce of butter, 2 ounces of sugar, and then for
this
me
for a week.
For a week, yes. 1 egg in 6 weeks, and then if we heard tomatoes are coming to shop, we used to have to go and queue for about, you know, a couple of tomatoes. But all the other things were rationed, and they were very, very tight, because we often wondered how we managed. Because
did you feel hungry at all?
I can't remember.
I think we were all too busy rushing around, doing, you know, for work and things like that. You know, and, I mean, meals were scratch jobs anyway. You know, regardless of
you
what
had to
you
sort
know.
Of make up sausages if you could get them, and that to make up with like pies and things
forget,
like that.
Don't forget powdered egg.
Yeah, powdered egg. That was a bit atrocious, but you had no option.
Because bread wasn't rationed then, was it?
Bread.
Yeah. I think that was only rationed after the war, I remember.
Yeah,
yes, very likely was, yes.
It wasn't rationed as such, but...
Bacon was.
Did you have to take sandwiches to work, or was there a canteen there?
Well, there was a canteen, but... We used to come home, didn't we, because we lived so near.
And I mean, we couldn't really afford to sort of go and pay the canteen prices. So we used to go... Of course, when clothing coupons come in, that was a nightmare, because I mean, you know, you had to buy all your household things, everything were on your coupons as well. And same as if you were going to have a baby, all your napkins and everything were on coupons, so you couldn't afford to get clothes yourselves and that.
You didn't get a special allocation or anything?
No, I didn't get a special allocation, not of the coupons, no. And so I think I that was when I, you know, used to sort of make things as I possibly could and that. And but I say you just couldn't sort of wear. I mean, that was when that's when we stopped wearing hats, because we always wore hats and we're dressed up sort of going up to town and that. But when you couldn't buy hats, so that was when they let ladies into church without the hats. Because I mean, otherwise we'd always had to wear hats and that, which we did. You could wear a scarf just to cover it, but I mean, apart from that, you were allowed to go in without a hat, because you couldn't buy a hat. There were no end of things that you weren't available, so you just couldn't have them and that.
I suppose you never got a Sunday joint or anything.
How much
meat did you get?
It was about one sixth worth a week.
Yeah, it used to be. It used to be a very small piece divided in two when it was even smaller, which time you cooked it. When you think back now, we do wonder how we did survive.
Because we used to grow vegetables, so we used to eat the vegetables and that mostly on that, so meats and that. There were tinned, of course, tinned corned beef and everything, we had
Spam.
That. Spam.
Spam wasn't bad.
No, but that was on coupons. I mean, it wasn't bad. So you had a tin and you had to sort of make it last or put it in batter or something. Have them and that.
I suppose you never got a Sunday joint or anything.
How much
meat did you get?
It was about one sixth worth a week.
It used to be a very small piece divided in two when it was even smaller, which time you cooked it. When you think back now, we do wonder how we did survive.
Because we used to grow vegetables, so we used to eat the vegetables and that mostly on that, so meats and that. There were tinned, of course, tinned corned beef and everything, we had
Spam.
That. Spam.
Actually, Spam wasn't bad.
No, but that was on coupons. I mean, it wasn't bad. So you had a tin and you had to sort of make it last or put it in batter or something if you could sort of get some flour or something like that. So, I've honestly forgotten how we did sort of manage in that, but we did. We never really went hungry in that.
And you never overweight or anything. I mean, they reckon that the population was the best fed it ever was and the most healthy
I think
during
that's
the war
was,
years
yes.
when it didn't overeat.
Because it wasn't like UFO. I was swimming then.
What about milk? Was that unrationed?
Yes, that was rationed as well. Yeah. Yes, yes. And I used to sort of give that to the aircraft workers, had to have that. Or those are working on the dope, they had to have an extra pint a day and that on the, you know, working on the dope on the. And so that was rationed. You were just allowed so much in that because you'd get half pints in those days.
About a half pint a day?
Yeah, I think it was about half pint a day we were allowed on that. Then we had powdered milk, you see, we had to sort of substitute for that, which you tried to make up into a pudding if you could, to sort of take the taste off and to make something substantial. But I don't know what we used to.
Long time ago
then. No, and then of course when fuel was short, when Vickers shut down for about
winter 47,
they shut down for how many weeks?
Oh, I forget now.
We had to couldn't get any fuel, couldn't get any coal, so we used to go down the canal and get bits of wood, and in those days we had a boiler in the kitchen, those sort of the old little ideal boiler. So we used to try and get this bit of wood, sit over that, and then to open the gas stove door, put that on just to get warm and that, and sit there with the clothes on. Hey, that was the awful part of it. I mean, it was miserable in that, really. And then used to put, that's when we used to get these sausages and make a bit of a pie and put it in the oven, so try and bake it at the same time and that. So that was a miserable time, really, in that. But that's all you could do, because you could just
I think that was as bad as any time we ever had, I think, 1947.
After the war.
Yeah. Mm. 47, when everything froze up. Oh, it was terrible.
But they are.
We were short of fuel, see, and there was no heating in the factory. And I tell you how bad it was. Even the hydraulic froze. And by gum, you know, it's got to be bad for that to freeze. It was hanging down in icicles, you know, from the way it had burst the different joints, having frozen that. Because we used hydraulic a lot for riveting, you see. And I say that was really bad. And it really was a bad time, 47. And it lasted for weeks, didn't it?
Yeah.
Weeks it lasted. And of course, there was no employment, nothing. We couldn't do any work, so they put us all off. And we were all on the dole.
So you managed to get some dole anyway in those days.
Yeah, we managed, yeah.
What is your, how much was it? Do you remember? How much a week?
I don't know. It wasn't very much, I know, but it was... I think that was about the worst time I remember. I think it really was bad, because we were short of everything, you know, and transport was up the creek, wasn't it? Everything was, everything was more or less on stop because of the shortage of fuel.
But the most miserable time was really the blackout, because, I mean, you know, you couldn't just go anywhere, and you've got to have your curtains drawn and stuff, and you couldn't have lights on and that, and because we had all that blackout, didn't we, during the war? That was really...
You had a radio, presumably.
The radio, yeah, but it didn't work after... Once the warning went, the radio was no good after. It was all a mass of static, so you just sort of switch it off. Because they used to
shut it down
or jam it or whatever, because they reckon that they used to use it to home in on, see? Tune into it, and I don't know how they did it, but I thought that was the explanation at the time. So radio was no good once the warning, the bomber warning, the raid warning came up. That was it, and the radio was finished.
Who was that you had working? Was it Gorn working in the works before when he came? One of the Germans.
He came over there, yeah.
Ribbentrop.
He was shown round the works.
And they're telling the rest when you remember.
That was just before the war, and in 1938 that was, and we were on about number 10 or 12 or something like that aircraft, And we used to have a square of blackboard fixed onto the jig, you see, and they used to chalk the number of what it was as it went down the shop. And just before he came around, the foreman came around and put another one. He said, instead of 12, it'd be 112, you know, on a bit of camouflage. But he was a great big tall chap, he was.
He was the German ambassador, I believe, at the time, wasn't he?
I think he lived in St George's Hills at the time. But I remember him, he'd been shown round, and there was a bit of, you know, everybody thought was a bit surprised about it all, that he was being shown round like. But anyway, it did happen. He was shown round the works.
That's right, I know.
And they just put this number one in front of to camouflage and how many we'd made. You know, we'd made 100 and whatever instead of 10 or something.
Tell me, when we were having coffee, you were mentioning about the time that Vickers was bombed on the day.
Yes.
Can you recall that for the record?
I can recall it because it was on September the 4th, and it was about 1:27.
Which year was this?
1940. And I was just getting ready to go out and the kitchen window and looking out because it was a beautiful day, and I saw these aircraft coming in low. I thought, you know, goodness, aircraft are low. That's just swooping in. And the next thing I heard, I thought, well, I hope they're not ours. Hope they're ours. And next thing was this crash, crash, crash. And they were Germans. And there were no barrage balloons up because at Vickersfield had they barrage balloons all around. There were no barrage balloons up. There were no, and all the crews, the gunners, were sort of sunbathing on the track, around the track, so that they had no sort of opposition than that. They just sort of came
in. No one
saw them coming. It was a bright sun, they know.
There was no warning.
Well,
no,
they're Stukas, dive bombers.
Yes, about six.
Well, people did say they were Focke-Wulf 190s that were especially adapted, you know, to do
they
that.
Just came
whether
in,
they were or not, I
swept, because our house was just sort of near me. Just came in, swept, and then sort of just out again. Had no opposition, I say, and that's when, how many people were killed? Quite a lot.
100 and something.
Because it was about 1:27 and they were just going back in for lunch and that. But fortunately, my husband was on night shift that, and so he went straight away in to help, sort of, atrocious apparently, and his, where his box was, his toolbox, was only in smithereens, so if he'd been there.
There was a sliver of grass through it about 18 inches long, I should say, and it quarter plate glass, and it went straight through the lid, right through the tray, and then, you know, down into the bottom.
Glass went through metal?
Yeah. No, wood.
Wooden toolbox.
It went straight through it, as though it was paper, you know, straight through. So you can imagine what some of the people were injured, terrible injuries from the glass, you know. And although the glass had been, they put wire netting up, of course, it blew the wire netting away and the glass just fell down. A lot of people got injured through the flying glass.